This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Well, glad to see you all here. I know there's a lot of choices at this conference and lots of great panels going on at the same time, but we're very excited that you chose to spend this hour and a half with us. I'm Rosie. I'm going to be chairing this panel, which is hosted in part by Salvage, the magazine that I edit and which you can find in the book room and always ask me about. And with that, I'm very excited to announce our speakers to introduce you. So closest to me here, we have Nada Aliyah, who teaches at the Department of Ethnic Studies at Western Washington University. She's the author of Greater Than the Sum of Our Parts, Feminism, Inter/Nationalism, and Palestine. Also a book in French that I'm not going to butcher the title of, but you can talk about it if you like. And is currently completing Palestiniyat, A Century of Palestinian Feminisms. Nada is a member of the Palestinian Feminist Collective, former president of the Association for Middle East Women's Studies, and has previously served on the steering collectives of Insight, Feminists of Color Against Violence, and the Arab Women's Solidarity Association. So please give Nada a welcome. And next to her, we have Nadine Naba? Who is a scholar activist, founder of Liberate Your Research Workshops, and a professor at UIC in Gender and Women's Studies. She is co-founder of MAMA's Activating Movements for Abolition and Solidarity and the Arab American Cultural Center, and works with Insight, Palestine Force, Palestinian Feminist Collective in Chicago, and the Journal of Palestine Studies. She's the author or co-editor of 6 books, including Arab America and okay. You can see her website. For more details, please give Nadine a welcome. So we're going to do this session a little differently than maybe some of the other panels that you've been in that we're going to do a kind of co-presentation. So Nada is going to speak, then she's going to bring in Nadine, who's going to fill in, and then they're going to switch back again because we're doing a kind of historical overview and they're going to do some different parts, which I think is going to be really fun. So without further ado, I'll get out of your way, and please welcome our speakers.
So what Nadine and I are going to do today is present a historical overview of Palestinian feminist activism over the past century, basically since the 1920s to the 2020s. And we're covering a lot of ground, so it's going to be truncated, it's going to be in spurts, it's going to be, you know, collaborative. Like, I'm going to be focusing primarily on the early history of Palestinian feminism in the homeland, and then when we get to the diaspora, Nadine jumps in and speaks about that, and hopefully by the end of our talk, you're going to have a good idea of the continuity of Palestinian feminism for the past century, over the past century, and from the river to the sea to the diaspora, because we may be fragmented geographically, we are politically very united. So I'm going to be focusing, and again, I'm going to focus more on the early and in more detail on the early decades, because they are the lesser known ones, and because that's the research for my next book, so it's not, it's there and I have to get it out. Okay, and it's actually important to understand our feminism, our Palestinian feminism, as an indigenous decolonial practice. This is really important for two reasons. First, it responds to misapprehensions from within our own Palestinian communities about feminism being an imported Western concept that is irrelevant to national struggle, right? These misapprehensions are somewhat fading now, but because of the gravity of the accelerated genocide, but they cannot be fully dismissed, and they are likely to reappear every now and then. I mean, every few decades we have these, like, what, feminism? That's a Western concept. It's like it seems to be a cyclical accusation, so we need to actually really assert that Palestinian feminism is not a colonial imposition. If anything, it is an anti-colonial indigenous impulse, right? And it's something that came up when the Palestinian Feminist Collective first launched, and we, the Palestinian Feminist Collective, and Nadine and I are both members of the Palestinian Feminist Collective, we actually had to deal with these accusations when we launched our pledge, Palestine is a Feminist Issue. The pledge was issued on March 15, 2021, to mark Women's History Month, and it says, ours is a vision for a radically different future based on life-affirming interconnectedness, empowering the working classes, and love for each other, land, life, and the planet itself. For these reasons, we pledge today and every day to recognize Palestine as a feminist issue and to uphold this commitment in our daily lives and organizing praxis. And as the pledge circulated, members of our own Palestinian communities expressed their discomfort with the term feminism, which they associated with middle-class white liberal women, with the faux feminists, you know, who are expressing outrage today at the alleged rape of Israeli women, but never at the documented rape and sexual violence that Israel has been engaging against Palestinians for over a century. So. If you associate feminism with that, with what I call faux feminism, then of course I would not want to be a feminist, right? But we have to actually document how Palestinian feminism is a form of feminism. It is indigenous, it is decolonial. The second reason it's important to establish Palestinian feminism as a decolonial practice in the far diaspora here is because the argument that the struggle for Palestinian liberation is an indigenous decolonial feminist practice situates Palestinian feminism firmly within the tradition of indigenous and women of color feminisms by foregrounding what we have in common with our co-strugglers here on Turtle Island. And this is something that, again, primarily, actually, Nadine is going to be speaking about. She's going to be speaking primarily about activism here in the U.S., where I'm going to be speaking primarily about activism in Palestine. Placing our Palestinian activism within the tradition of indigenous and women of color feminisms here means we are not just in solidarity with each other, but that our struggles are inescapably interconnected. We are similar, and maybe similar, but not the same, but certainly we have the same struggles. Anti-colonial, anti-racist, that's the same struggle. And I don't want to dismiss solidarity when I say we're not necessarily in solidarity, we're in the same struggle. I don't want to dismiss solidarity. I think we do very often act in solidarity, but we also share the same struggle as subjects of empire, and that shared struggle is not solidarity. If we are subjects of empire, of the same empire, of the same forces of settler colonialism, that are interconnected, then we are not in solidarity, we're in the same struggle. And knowing that we're in the same struggle is a different approach to struggling. So together with indigenous feminists and feminists of color, we're not just fighting patriarchy, sexism, and homophobia within our own communities, which unfortunately they do exist, we're also fighting for the abolition of the macro environment of systemic oppression. Colonialism, occupation, war, policing, racial capitalism, with their myriad gendered manifestations that impact us in the larger society we function in, but which also trickle down to the domestic sphere. So, again, this is just to contextualize what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be giving an overview, somewhat decade by decade, definitely truncated, of the trajectory of Palestinian feminist decolonial activism from the 1920s to the present. And as I said, almost decade by decade, and certainly truncated. So starting with the 1990s, I'm looking and at the 1920s in Palestine, in Palestine. The most influential newspaper in Palestine in the early 20th century was called Palestine, and it was published out of Jaffa. And the reason I bring it up is because back in the 1910s, we had a newspaper called Palestine. For all the people who say, you know what, Palestine only existed after Israel and it only came to be a concept for us after Zionism. No, in 1910 there was a Palestine a newspaper coming out of Jaffa that was called Palestine. But I just had to say that because the second most important newspaper coming out of Palestine in the 1920s was called Al Karmel. It was published out of Haifa. And it was founded and edited by Najib Nassar, and within a few years, the co-editor was Sadej Nassar, Najib's spouse, and she wrote two columns a week in that newspaper, the second most influential newspaper in Palestine, called Al Karmel, and she wrote two columns a week in it, and both columns were about women's issues. And they were not about cooking and knitting and scrubbing the floor. They were about the national struggle and what it takes for women to be part of the national struggle for liberation. So we have, back in the 1920s, Shadiz Nassar's articles, and some of them, like, they encouraged Palestinian mothers to raise their children on the basis of equality between boys and girls. I mean, back in 1920s, she was writing, raise your boys and girls similarly. Do not do gender stereotyping as you raise your kids. She called for educating Palestinian women. She called for providing for paid work opportunities. She attacked the dominant social ills in society. For example, child marriage. She was very, very active against that. And those were in the second most influential newspaper in Palestine. Again, I mean, she could not have done that for... Oh, and the paper was shut down over and over and over again by the British mandate when they came in because of her very unsilenced, uncensored call for national struggle. In addition to her journalistic work, Nassar played a role in mobilizing and organizing Palestinian women. In 1930, in collaboration with Maryam al-Khalil, she co-founded the Arab Women's Union in Haifa, which played a prominent role in the general strike of 1936. There was a panel yesterday on the strike of 1936 to 39. Women were very active in it. She took part in women's demonstrations that accompanied that strike. The 20s were very active years, and I say that because, again, I'm trying to show the continuity into the 2020s. The 20s were very active year. 1921 saw the formation of the Arab Women's Union. 1929 saw the formation of the Arab Women's Congress. And both of these organizations had two intertwined goals, completely inseparate: national and social liberation. Women, even back then, knew that there could be no national liberation without social liberation. And they fought for an overall change in women's circumstances, in education, child marriage, employment, even political participation. Child marriage, for example, which was relatively common, they knew that it took national liberation to end it because they're like, we cannot go to any kind of, we cannot legislate against it if we don't have a nation. Therefore, we must have a sovereign nation in order to legislate for the end of child marriage, right? So they knew that it took national liberation to improve social circumstances. And jumping to the 30s, see, I told you I was going to do very, like, chopped. So we just talked about the 20s. Now we're talking about the 30s. Jumping to the 30s, we also see an uninterrupted Palestinian women's feminist decolonial activism. Again, the panel yesterday by PFC members about the 36-39 revolution, revolt against Britain's imperial plans. And women were very active in that. They, again, just as in the Algerian Revolution, they smuggled weapons, they delivered food to the fighters. In 1937, Mathilde Mohannem published a book called The Arab Woman and the Palestine Question. And that book offers some of the most insightful Palestinian decolonial analysis ever. The book is available online from Birzeit University, from the Women's Studies Department at Birzeit University. read it. It's just amazing. It's mind-blowing. Every time I go back to it, it's like what she was writing there in 1937. You know, criticizing the British mandate, saying the most detrimental, harmful enemy of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause is the British mandate, right? And she was talking about that, and she was talking about how women had to overcome social restrictions and traditions and conservative norms in order to be part of the national struggle. She was writing that in the 30s. So that covers the 30s. And then her book was published in 37, but she was very active. There were a lot of women's organizations. I mean, like, the country was covered in women's organizations, some of them very local. Some Haifa, Yafa, Ramallah, every town had something. And very frequently they came together, right? And then we jumped to the 1940s, and 1948, of course, saw Palestinian women once again engaging in the most transformative acts of feminism. And I do believe that feminism is transformative. Feminism is not about getting a bigger piece of the pie. It is about changing the ingredients of the pie, right? So that's what I mean by transformative feminism. And the feminism of Palestinian women has been transformative. It's like we have to change this, you know, even though, like, for example, I would say that Matin Mohannem tried to work with the master's tools to some degree, but always knew that, no, we need social transformation. Very strategic, very savvy, a brilliant woman. So when I say the most transformative acts, I think no one personifies that better than Sitt Hind al-Husseini, the founder of Dar al-Tifl al-Arabi. And Hind al-Husseini was a social worker in 1948. She had been a teacher for a few years, and then she decided that her calling was social worker. And of course, we've all heard of the Deir Yassin massacre on April 9, 1948. But she's the one who came across the 50 orphaned children, and she saw these orphaned children by Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, they had been dropped off by the Zionist militias who had killed their parents in Deir Yassin, and they had been transported into Jerusalem and dropped off in Jerusalem on the same trucks where their parents had been basically loaded and dumped. So these 50 totally traumatized children dropped off in Jerusalem, and she was literally going to, with a friend, to a social work meeting, and she saw these kids and she said, where are you? Where are your parents? Who are you? And like 50 kids under the age of 9. And she totally took them under her wing, adopted them. She comes from a very wealthy family, so she used her grandparents' mansion and transformed it into Dar al-Tifl al-Arabi and adopted these 50 children. And it became an orphanage that is open to this day, that it used to be, of course, at first she was not selective. It's like all the 50 orphans come here. And then inspired by her Dar al-Tifl al-Arabi, there was a school that opened across the street for boys when she decided that she would have a girls' orphanage. And then there was Dar al-Walad al-Arabi, which opened across the street from her, which took boys. But she never separated families. If the siblings were like boy and girl siblings, she would take them in because they didn't go to the boys' orphanage. Anyway, and the way she set up that orphanage, she was truly phenomenal. She made sure it was an Islamic waqf in order to be free of government interference. Because if you're an Islamic waqf, then you have more self-control over stuff. And she controlled the curriculum so that it would not be imposed by the government. And to this day, it's a free curriculum. She was very, very political. She raised women. And for my yet next book, I'm doing interviews with some of the women who went through that school, and they all say she was so empowering. She made us all feel strong, worthy, and she hired as teachers, she hired some of the people who had been political prisoners and could not get jobs otherwise. So just about everyone going through that school was educated by very radical political former prisoners, right? She hired those kind of people, and she told women to stand tall, to walk walk strong, stand tall. She made them feel so proud. Every woman that I have interviewed coming out of that orphanage, and it was an orphanage, but also it took in very poor people who could not afford, whose parents basically sent them there for a good free education, and she took them in. So. And she created some kind of mutual aid in that she was well connected in she's the Husseini family, so she was well connected. She went, for example, and she created what I call mutual aid before it was known as mutual aid. Of course, not because it didn't before it existed, because mutual aid has always existed. But she set that into motion. So she went to the mayor of Jerusalem at the time, because she knew him through family connections, and she said, "I want you to ask the people to start helping, because I've just taken in 50 kids." And the Dar al-Tifl is still, as I said, it still functions to this day. And so she told the mayor that she needed to make sure that everyone who goes in gets donates something. And he said at the beginning, he said, it's like he's got the agenda with everyone's whatever item, agenda item. And he goes, "I will not get to yours unless you commit to donating something to this orphanage. They are our children. These are the orphans of Deir Yassin. If you want your item looked at, you have to pledge something." And then, and that continued to this day. To this day, people donate to Dar al-Tifl. That's what I call transformative feminism, right? So that's basically, when we look at the 1940s and we look at the Nakba, it's also good to know, to look at what else was going on, and there was that going on. We are survivors. Every Palestinian today is a survivor, and the 50s, unfortunately, were about basically surviving. They were about disbursement. They were about staying alive against the imperial genocidal odds, and families everywhere were being displaced, and we were moving from one town to another, and many families after the 48 actually moved to the U.S. and or all over the place. You know, my own family, for example, I was born in Iraq. My family lived in all over the, Kuwait, Iraq, Jordan only recently, Abu Dhabi, and all of these countries. That was basically, it became the normal of Palestinians to be, I mean, we have more people in the diaspora than we do in the homeland. So, and then 1967 happened, and Israel took over the rest of Palestine, and the Western world cheered. Of course it cheered that, because it was yet more imperial settler colonial conquest. So, and particularly in the U.S., which Palestinians had moved to, the shock of seeing people rejoicing over Israel's defeat of the Arab militaries prompted Palestinians to organize here in the diaspora, and this is where I pass the mic to Nadine, who can tell us about the organizing in the diaspora.
Okay. I know, she'll be back for more. It's such crucial work that Neda's doing. I mean, it's not easy to be, digging up these histories, these forgotten histories, and we need it. So thanks for that. When we talk about, I'm kind of repeating something Neda said, but it's so important that if you think about it, more Palestinians live in the diaspora than in Palestine. And Palestinians have always seen our movement as all Palestinians all over the world who are, committed, are part of Palestinian liberation, a Palestinian liberation movement. And so the U.S. and the imperial forces have repeatedly attempted to crush that connection, to isolate Palestinian diasporas from their homeland. And we need to challenge that by repeatedly insisting that, this is one people participating in one liberation movement. I'm not talking about that because the panel is about feminism, but we can even think of you know, refugee camps in Lebanon that were key sites of like learning and training resistance. And so I'm saying that for two reasons. One, to say that when I talk about the diaspora, I'm not doing like homeland and diaspora. I'm not doing domestic and global. I'm doing an imperialist force, a colonial force, colonizing Palestinians with the attempt to erase Palestinians and disappear them off of their land. And that dispersion then to the United States, to the belly of the beast, that Palestinians living in the US are facing a targeting that isn't just racism. It's an attempt to crush Palestinian resistance, an attempt to crush our liberation movement. And I say that too to say that the shape of our movement, that's the US part of it, is always changing due to many factors. One is the context of Israeli state violence. So in all over the years that I'm going to talk about, if in one moment Israeli violence is less violent, you know, whatever that means, like if you say the first Intifada in the 80s, you had way more opportunities for all Palestinians to participate in resistance. So you had a stronger feminist movement. So you had all civil society, every child care, every orphanage, every library, every social worker, every baker was part of resistance. But then with the second Intifada, which started in 2000, when Israel was intentionally shooting children from the waist up to kill them, the fighting ended up playing out between soldiers and young men at checkpoints, where you saw like the stone and the guns. And that marginalizes women and queer and trans people who are not, you know, who are women from the resistance. So you have a crushing of the capacity and possibility of feminist organizing. And then that's one thing that changes. So when I'm gonna be talking about the different moments of resistance, that's gonna be, we need to think about all of these things as affecting it. So another thing that affects it is what's going on with US state violence, right? Because we're talking about the US. So there might be, and not only against Arabs and Muslims, Palestinians, but also against like, you know, all of our people of color movements and indigenous people. So there might have been moments where, you know, there's more possibility, and there might be moments where that resistance is crushed. So I'll be going over that. So when we talk about, that's why I'm gonna just enter into the 60s, and that's when the US first confirms its unconditional alliance with Israel. And that's the first time Arabs and Palestinians, and I'm just gonna say Arabs for as a shorthand, the term's problematic, and also because in the diaspora, it's not just Palestinians, but it's a broad Arab movement. So in the 60s period was the first time Arab people started feeling that the US was waging a war against us. So you had like the growth, but it was also the time of civil rights and national liberation movements, third world liberation all over the world. So to give that context, you already had Palestinian organizing. It was also organizing with leftist Lebanese, leftist Iraqi, leftist Yemeni in organizations like Organization of Arab Students. But you also had a student nonviolent coordinating committee, and you had, so in the Palestinian spaces, you already had a feminist consciousness, because it's going to mirror what Neda was saying was happening in Palestine. So in the US, when you had the gender consciousness emerging among, you know, Black Power movements, and the formation of groups like Black Women's Liberation Committee in SNCC that led to the Third World Women's Alliance, and now we're talking about the 70s, in that context, that movement, the feminist of color US movement, was already internationalist because it was the context of third world liberation movements. So people were already organizing around liberation struggles in Latin America. A lot of us already know this, so I'm not going to repeat it. But what matters for what we're talking about is there was a consciousness that was decolonial, anti-imperialist, and the struggle to end the Vietnam War. So people around, you know, that time were already organizing and fighting in solidarity with feminist movements in Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, Vietnam, Central America. And in that context, members of the Third World Women's Alliance and the Black Women's Liberation Committee were getting trained by Palestinian feminists. And some of them were leaders from Chicago, that a lot of us know, like Camelia Audet was training folks in Oakland around Palestine. And that formation was the umbrella of the Palestinian Women's Associations. And it was an umbrella for many different Palestinian organizations. And one of the things that they did are educational series on Palestinian history, connecting their struggle with other feminist movements. So that was kind of like 70s, and it moves into the 80s. So by the time the first Intifada, the first Palestinian uprising, grows in the US in 1987 and beyond, you already have those ties and connections. I have so many stories about this. I've done a lot of research and interviewed a lot of the folks. Maybe in the question answer, if you want, I could give you some of the fun stories. But you had, but you also had some divisions in the US left that trickled into feminist spaces. Like you had Zionism in the left trying to crush and marginalize Palestinian women out of some of these spaces. And that came up already, that was already happening in the 1983, there was a publication, the Alliance Against Women's Oppression, and it was outed this problem of like Zionism in the women's movement. So now I was talking a little bit about the first Intifada, the 1980s. So one of the things that happens is that the US and Israel basically crush the first Palestinian uprising through the so-called peace process. And I have no time to talk about that. That's not part of this panel. But the peace process we call normalization of colonization, because it was like false promises that were never, you know, realized. So what does that mean? Now we're talking about the 90s. So we're in the 90s now. In the 90s, you have almost like a halt around Palestinian resistance, because people are expecting the results of the peace process to be implemented. So what happens among Palestinian feminist organizing in the US is that, this is super complicated, is that that crushing of Palestinian resistance in the US has a gendered effect among the Palestinian resistance movement in the US, so that the people who paid the heaviest price were women. And a lot of women who were like leaders in the 80s, by the 90s, they either moved back to Palestine or were struggling to keep their families alive. Because a lot of those families, their livelihood came from the movement. So they might have had like a restaurant or a bookstore, and it was all connected to growing the movement. So when the movement was crushed, they lost everything. And who pays the price of that? Women and caregivers, right? So what was odd about that is in the 90s, the US is now growing as an empire, and it's, you know, bombing Iraq to smithereens, sanctions killing 5,000 Iraqi kids per month. While that's happening, now you have another strand growing in the US, which is this anti-war on Iraq movement that, you know, was way before September 11th. And with that, there is the consciousness around Palestine, because Israel is now using the peace process to intensify its strategies of violence against Palestinians. Like we said, like now we're seeing shooting children from the waist up. We're seeing Mohammed Dedoura, for those of you who remember him, shot on his father's lap. And then after that, they shot his father, and that image circulated all over the world. And that really mobilized people around like late 90s, 2000. So now you have like this revival happening, but in that revival, there's an absence of a lot of Palestinian women. That's what I was gonna say. And we came up in that, Neda and I. So what's happening then is, now I'm gonna, so take that for 1 minute and just like, you know, keep it if you can, hold it. Because now I'm gonna talk about radical feminist of color organizing in the 90s. So what's happening there is you also had a little bit of a downtime. You know, we're talking like the post-national liberation movements, the US trying to crush resistance, the Reagan administration, and you have like liberal multicultural politics that also are similar to the peace process, like this new liberalism. making it seem like everything's okay. So then a lot of people not doing much. But what starts happening is a new feminist of color consciousness. And you could see it with organizations like the Woman of Color Resource Center in Oakland, which had people from SNCC, from the Third World Women's Alliance, you know, who are now like a decade or two later coming back to the table with new generations who are now like aware of Palestine, aware of global economic neoliberalism, fighting privatization and the prison industrial complex. So you had this formation of women of color organizing that was anti-imperialist and global in the 90s that starts integrating for the first time since that earlier period, Palestinian, Arab, Iranian, bringing folks to the table, like making sure that there's an Iraqi feminist at the Women of Color Resource Center in Oakland, if that makes sense. So that's kind of going on in the late 90s. I'm saying all this being very careful because I'm not mentioning September 11th yet, because this is pre. And you could tell me, should I talk for 5 more minutes, you think? Okay, so there's so much to say about that because it was an extremely powerful moment. And a lot of us thought like, kind of, and we launched international divestment. And we thought that things were changing. And then September 11th happens, right? So now 2001, and also as part of that late 90s feminist of color moment, the Insight movement is born. Insight, Feminists of Color Against Violence. Look it up if you want, because I'm not gonna have time to talk about it if you're interested, or you could ask me later. So Insight is, what the way we talk about Insight now, looking back on it, is gonna be a huge mouthful, decolonial, anti-imperialist abolition. Because what happened in Feminist of Color, what Insight was doing was saying that the U.S. was founded on settler colonialism, and prisons and captivity have always been part of genocide and colonization, and that when the U.S. enacts genocides and wars and militarism abroad, it strengthens its power here and strengthens like prisons and policing. So it was all about connecting all of the different structures of white supremacy and then bringing in people targeted by those, like women and queer and trans people from all these communities, into like a coalitional movement that understood that all our struggles are connected. So that was like late 1990s, but then September 11th happens and so much organizing happens around integrating even more strongly Palestinian and Arab and Iranian, Afghan folks into this feminist of color movement. So what happens then, now to kind of wrap it up is, and bring it to today, is that Insight, you might remember those posters, genocide does not equal justice. How many of you remember that poster? Genocide does not equal justice, we can age ourselves, right? So they were posters about the US war on Afghanistan. And they were challenging and creating like a, challenging the narrative, like trying to replace the imperialist narrative that the US is going to war in Afghanistan to save the women with another framing, which is, you know, genocide does not equal justice, that genocide is not gonna liberate women. And what's interesting about that, I thought about that while I was reflecting on this presentation, that Arab feminists had already been saying that in the early 90s when the US started bombing Iraq in the first Gulf War. We went to Beijing. I'm not trying to talk about myself, but our organization, Arab Women Solidarity Association, went to Beijing, the Global Conference on Women, 1984, making the case about that, about the Iraq War. And so now everyone, now that same analysis was integrated into US feminist of color organizing. That's my point. So then you have the, you know, through that, those coalitions, you have Insight created Palestine Points of Unity, this coalitional group committing to Palestine, and then we lost all our funding from the Ford Foundation, which is a whole other thing that we can talk about if you want. And then where does that bring us? That brings us to, and really like what I want to uplift here is that one of the many underlying ideas here is that, you know, wars abroad, depend on sexualized violence and gender violence. And I can make a list of what all those are, but I think we know, but including, you know, denial of access to healthcare after you bomb a hospital, food, water, all the things that affect like reproductive injustices and all that. But the idea was that US militarism abroad and all its gendered and sexual violences that are always part of US militarism have a ripple effect in the lives of women, queer, and trans people of color here. That those two are connected, and therefore our struggles are connected, because when the US cops are sharing technology with the US military, that technology is being used to displace houseless women in Oakland from their homes with cops driving tanks, the same that are funded by the same companies that are, you know, running over Palestinian families with the tanks. So that was kind of this idea that our struggles are the conjoined struggle thing. So 2017, I'll just give a few tidbits, as the Women's March was like this idea of like, oh, Palestinian feminism is now part of the Women's March, and then that got shut down with the claim of anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, so, you know, people then stepped down from the Women's March. So these are all examples of when Palestinian feminism gets integrated into like US feminist movements. So I was just giving another example outside of Insight. And then you have the, where are we now? Where are we now is that, you know, then you had the 2020 uprisings, and you had Ferguson was in 2014. So 2014 and then 2020. So how does that shape where we are today around the coalitions and integration of Palestinian feminist resistance and US feminist color resistance? Is that you have a much more like robust, powerful, consciousness around this idea of these, our struggles are connected. So some of the examples would be like the militarized surveillance that, Palestinian and Arab and Muslim communities are facing, that there's a consciousness now, right? That the cops are sharing data with the Department of Homeland Security. And people from the movement of Black Lives were targeted with terrorism charges, right? So there's like this, you know, that kind of already, like I was saying before, that the context of US racial violence shapes the ways that these coalitions, how these coalitions look. Since the genocide started, so Insight kind of was dormant for a while for many different reasons. But Insight kind of, we revived Insight after the genocide started and call it Insight Palestine Force. Can you show the t-shirts? And I want to talk about the t-shirts and the posters because I'm not going to talk as much about like what we did since the genocide started, but one thing I want to leave us with is about, I kind of want to leave us with something uplifting a little bit, is the role of art and posters and these like slogans in our organizing. So when the war in Afghanistan went down, I reminded you about those posters. Those posters emerge out of relations Insight formed with members of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women in Afghanistan, and Mina, who is crucial revolutionary woman from Afghanistan, and it was her image on that poster. And interestingly, the Insight poster from this genocide is Hiba Zarut, a Palestinian artist who Israel recently killed in the beginning of the genocide. So we kind of said we're going to take the same strategy we used in 2001 in 2023, which was to create these posters and remind people of the significance of like feminist anti-militarist organizing that was so powerful after September 11th, but has been lost over the past 20 years. And there's, even abolition movements have, there was a moment of like turning back and becoming focused more on the domestic and losing the anti-militarist, anti-imperialist piece. So we were trying to like say, you know, let's not forget that our abolitionist organizing has always been anti-imperialist and anti-militarist. So we have the shirts, and then, okay, done. And then I'll say that we had the, I want to talk about the Chilean, and then the other thing was a dance that, and so these posters you might have seen, how many of you have seen that image on posters around the genocide? And they've really just been all over the world as an alternative framing. And then there was another solidarity with Chilean feminists during this genocide, Palestinian and feminists of color, with a performance, and my Spanish is really bad, but it was the Un Violador en Tu Camino, which is, anyone want to say what that is? Audience participation? The Rapist in Your Path. So this was a song that Chilean feminists sang on the streets, and they came together against these sexualized violence, and then we rewrote, and in solidarity with feminists in Chile, we rewrote the words to be about Palestine and Israel, saying the rapist is you, the murderer is you, about Israel and the US. And then that was a choreographed dance that activists have done in a lot of the protests around this genocide. So I think I'll just close with that to say that, that yeah, Neda is gonna come up here now. The thing I was going to close with was the other shirt, which is about, which is a solidarity with an indigenous, is to say that the work now is basically saying that challenging the isolation of Palestine as a single issue, that the liberation of Palestine is necessary for the liberation of all our communities. And this was like, this is a, draws on the, Hand on Your Mouth poster, Indigenous women, missing and murdered Indigenous women, that has been talked about at this conference. And this is, again, in solidarity and in coalition with that struggle to say that Palestine is an Indigenous feminist issue around Turtle Island as well.
Thank you, Nadine. We can do it. We can do it. All right, so I'm going to go back to Palestine. I'm going to go back a couple of decades, where basically I had stopped, I think, at the first intifada of the 80s, and again, looking at decades. You know, the first intifada, I think everybody who knows anything about the first intifada knows that it was a youth and women-led intifada. It was, again, very, very transformative. It was direct action, civil disobedience. It was grassroots organizing. It was mutual aid. It was co-ops. It was, in every way, at all levels, it was, again, what I would call a feminist intifada. And not just in vision, because of course feminism is not gender based, but in its practice, but also the women were running the underground schools, because of course, you know, just like now we have scholasticide, Israel had basically banned going to school, and so parents started running underground schools in their basements, that's a very American, yeah, basically. But like in their yards, in their gardens, they tended to community gardens. The women were once again smuggling weapons. They were sewing Palestinian flags. You know, all of you who are now seeing the watermelon. The watermelon started during the Palestinian Intifada, when basically Israel had banned the flying of the Palestinian flag, and so the watermelon, which is the Palestinian flag, is black, white, green, and red, and the watermelon, and Israel had banned the flying of the Palestinian flag, and so the watermelon became a symbol of that, because watermelon has those colors of the Palestinian flag, and it was illegal to do that. So women would go out and buy, like every single woman would go out and buy only one color in order not to be suspected. So one woman would buy all the green cloth that there was. One woman would buy all the white cloth. One woman would buy all the black cloth, and one woman would buy all the red cloth, so that nobody would suspect that they are buying the colors of the Palestinian flag. And then one day they would sit together in one woman's room, and they would sew these flags, and then they would fly them. again, that's what the origin of the watermelon that we see today, that because people were like, what, you know, like, what do you mean we can't fly? Like, someone was actually asking the Israeli authorities, and the Israeli authorities, no, these colors of the flags, and then they're like, so what if I were to fly a watermelon flag, right? And so even though the watermelon was not flown as a flag then, that was the origin of the watermelon that we see today. And again, women were buying one color at a time, one separate women. So that's the kind of like very creative organizing that happened during the First Intifada. And then, of course, the Oslo Accords happened. And the Oslo Accords, as Nadine said, really crushed that transformative feminist impulse. But no. It did not crush it. It pushed it underground. And we know that underground is the most fertile place, right? So on the 1990s pulled the rug from under our feminist speak, but we went underground. And again, underground, we were doing a lot. So the social transformation that had happened for all these decades continued. There was no stopping that, right? Patriarchy was increasing, and there was more resistance. So, for example, it's not an accident that Al-Qaws, which is the queer rights organization in Palestine, it's the largest, not the only, but the largest Palestinian queer rights organization, was founded in 2001. And of course, if it was founded in 2001, it's because there had been some background work, right? And Al-Qaws, on its website, they say that they once again twin national and social liberation. So on the website, this is something I got from their website. 5 minutes. For Palestinian society, all grassroots works is affected by Israeli colonialism and occupation. Right? For Palestinian society, all grassroots works is affected by Israeli colonialism and occupation. Al-Qaws has been demonstrating for over a decade that all political work intersects with issues that are sometimes dismissed as too personal, apolitical, or irrelevant, such as homosexuality and queer identity, non-normative gender, and so on. So this was in 2001 in Palestine, when we speak about how the 90s did not crush but sent us underground, then that's how we resurfaced. We resurfaced with Al-Qaws. And Al-Qaws was instrumental in educating the world about pinkwashing. And I think most people are familiar with pinkwashing. It was Al-Qaws that was instrumental in educating us about pinkwashing. And since I only have 5 minutes, if you have questions about pinkwashing, ask me about it later. All right. So another thing, that one of the transformations that were happening in society, was the slogan, Al-Ard Qabla Al-Ard, land before honor. And Al-Ard Qabla Al-Ard, or land before honor, is in some ways a double-edged sword, and it was basically a reflection of this of the sexual violence that Israel was engaging in against Palestinian women. It's like, listen, if you are being tortured in prison, and if you are going to be raped in prison, and if you're going to be threatened with sexual violence in prison, land before honor. We will forget about your honor for the sake of the land. And when I say it's double-edged, because of course the concept of honor should not be connected to one's sexuality or one's virginity or one's chastity. So land before honor, but there was that, again, honor is ethics, it's morals. It's not whether you have a hymen or not, right? So land before honor was problematic in that. That's what I mean by it's a double-edged sword. But it also was reflecting an awareness on the part of all of society, on a part of the most conservative people who truly believe that honor is one's chastity, that something is happening here. The sexual violence is transforming our society, right? And then with the intensifying oppression and intensifying patriarchy, then the concept of honor also resurfaced in Palestinian society. And so, and then we've heard about the femicides, we've heard about the murders of Isra Reyeb and so on. And another organization that was founded in that's really very, very important, and their slogan is "No free homeland without free women" is Talaat. And Talaat is a grassroots organization of Palestinian women who took to the streets in Palestine to denounce the horrific murder by her own Palestinian parents of Isra Rayib, a 21-year-old Palestinian from Jerusalem. And in a statement explaining their politics, Talaat writes, "We aspire to build a different world, for our emancipation is hinged on the shattering of capitalism, colonialism, and patriarchy all at once." Hence, Talaat does not prioritize making institutional demands, be it from the PA, the Palestinian Authority, and definitely not from the Israeli state. And so their analysis, the analysis of Talaat, is one of, okay, we are going through extreme repression from within, the honor crimes that have increased, as a result of an increase in the macro political level of oppression, you know, intensifying militarism, intensifying occupation, intensifying that. And so their slogan is "No free homeland without free Palestine." And that brings us to the present and to the fact that we are members of the Palestinian Feminist Collective. And as I said, I started with the Palestinian Feminist Collective at the beginning. So. And I want to emphasize that the Palestinian Feminist Collective, that Palestinian feminism today, that indigenous decolonial Palestinian feminism is not an aberration, it's not a mutation, it's a completely organic manifestation of the Palestinian, of the feminism that has characterized our people for the past century. The PFC is intentionally the sister of Talaat. We are dispersed geographically, but we are not fragmented politically. Today, the PFC is working for empowerment here in the belly of the beast, but also for the liberation of the homeland. And one example of how our work here as PFC is fully connected to the work of liberating Palestine in the homeland and liberating Palestinian women is the statement that we have issued about Khalida Jarrar. And you want to talk about Khalida Jarrar? Khalida Jarrar is a Palestinian feminist, visionary, radical abolitionist leader, and has been imprisoned, or you can say that, okay, has been imprisoned for about, what, 5 years, over 5 years?
2023 over.
She keeps getting imprisoned, and she has recently been imprisoned and is sent into separate 6 years and is now in solitary. And basically, she is an abolitionist, she is a feminist, and we are now issuing a statement in support of her, calling for the end of her detention, calling for the end of all administrative detention, and this is again how Palestinian feminism is abolitionist, is anti-imperial, anti-occupation, anti-militarism, anti-all of that. All
right. And then we're done. We tried really hard to get this done before the panel, but we'll announce it more again tomorrow at the closing. But there is a statement now on the Palestinian Feminist Collective's website as of like 5 minutes ago. We wanted to get it before this panel, and it's a free Khalida Jarrar statement, and we're asking folks to sign onto it. And there will be a campaign. So if you follow, we're in the next step will be in a full-fledged Free Khalida campaign. And this also has been deeply connected and in the works with US abolitionist organizing. Some of you might know of that newspaper called New York War Crimes that's been distributed at the protests coming out of, you know, movements against policing and prisons, especially in New York. And they already published a whole thing on Khalida like 6 months ago. So we already have that alliance with from the US, Turtle Island to Palestine around abolition. And Khalida's case is actually a major case that captures that alliance of abolition, feminist abolition here and there. And she's actually, I mean, right before they took her this last time, she was reading about the work of the organization I work with, Mamas, which is about US, it's about mothers of police torture survivors in Chicago, that draws on the work of people in this room like Chez and Joey Mogul and others who are sitting in front. We really need to like uplift that, because she's experiencing like really grave and profound harm and violence. So hopefully we can work on that too.
Okay, let's hear a round of applause for a century of Palestinian feminism in 40 minutes.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.